Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. On today's program, we have a Navy SEAL, combat veteran, Rhodes Scholar, PhD, humanitarian, and author, all in the person of one man, Eric Greitens. He'll be with us in a couple of moments. But first, looking at higher education through a somewhat different lens. Why is college so expensive? Why do so many students fail to finish college? And is there what in effect is a caste system preventing students from lower income households from attending college? And what role does politics play in all of this? Joining me in studio is someone who has written about it in some detail. Cornell University political scientist Dr. Suzanne Mettler is the author of Degrees of Inequality, How the Politics of Higher Education Sabotaged the American Dream. Dr. Mettler, it's so nice to have you with us.
I'm delighted to be here, Don. What a beautiful day to be in St. Louis.
You picked a perfect one, no question about that. Let me begin by asking about this widening gap that you write about between the haves and the have-nots. What's happening?
Well, in the middle of the 20th century, there were more and more Americans who were the first in their family to go to college. And at that point, we really thought of going to college as a pathway to the American dream. It was a way to expand opportunity. And I began this book several years ago wondering how higher education is functioning today in that respect. And what I found is that while for some students it does still provide a real ladder to opportunity, for too many it does not. And in many ways, overall, our system of higher education is reinforcing or even exacerbating inequality. There are actually some students today who go to college who end up worse off than if they had never attended in the first place.
Worse off in what way? Financially?
Who end up worse off financially. Yeah. I look at several policy trends that are going on these days. Perhaps the most egregious part of the story that emerged was the students who attend the for-profit colleges. This is the most rapidly growing sector of higher education. It now enrolls 1 in 10 college students. And these college students typically are come from very low-income backgrounds. They're the first in their family to attempt college. And they go to schools like the University of Phoenix and Kaplan, ITT, DeVry, et cetera. These schools recruit them, and they engage in very heavy recruitment, and get them to take out student loans right away. Now, often the students, once enrolled, find out that the education is not what they hoped it would be, and they drop out. But nearly all of them at that point have borrowed money to attend. So they're on the hook for those loans. They end up, even if they graduate from these schools, which only about 22% do, they end up often getting the same kind of job they would have even if they'd never enrolled, because employers don't really respect these schools very much. So these students have very high levels of debt. If they've graduated, on average, $33,000 in debt. So say they're going back to the same minimum wage level job they had before, they're really worse off.
But students going to the other institutions are also winding up with considerable debt, I'm sure at least equal to what you've just mentioned.
Yes, that's right. Now, many would talk about the problems with higher education today as simply being a problem of student loan debt, but I think that we need to have a more nuanced analysis. Some of that high student loan debt is for people who are going for graduate degrees, becoming doctors, lawyers, or who are getting undergrad degrees at top-notch institutions where they come out of those schools, they're able to get jobs, and they're able to pay off their loans. So that was a good investment for them. But for the students in for-profit colleges, and then in every sector of higher ed, there are some institutions that are bad actors that are recruiting in students but not giving them sufficient financial aid, and those students have difficulty both finishing and then repaying their loans often. But I think that we shouldn't just say that student loans are the problem across the board. We have to have a more nuanced analysis.
The for-profit institutions, just by way of comparison, what would the difference, the variance be in the cost of going to one school versus the nonprofits?
Well, typically you could go to a public university or college and get the same kind of training or education that you'd get at the for-profit for a much lower price. So for a four-year degree, the cost per year is going to be something like $15,000 at the for-profit, whereas it'll be around $8,000 or $9,000 at a public university or college. Now it'll be more if you go to a nonprofit private institution. But most of those have very high graduation rates, and so the tuition's not such a problem.
What does it cost to go to Cornell?
Cornell is high tuition. We're in the tuition alone now would be in the upper 30s. So it adds up to a good deal of money, but very high graduation rates. And so I think, you know, that tends to be a good investment for students.
Are the schools that you mentioned, the Kaplan's and the University of Phoenix, these are all online universities, are they not?
They've become increasingly online. Yeah. Now, in 1992, when the for-profit colleges already, well, we could go way back. They've been a problem for a long time in the United States. And in the 1980s, there were a lot of concerns about them because they had become newly eligible for using federal student aid dollars. And so a bipartisan group of lawmakers came together in Congress and regulated them in various ways. And one law was that for these schools to use federal student aid dollars, they had to give at least half of their classes for a student in a brick-and-mortar institution. But in 2006, Congress got rid of that law. So then these schools took off in terms of giving online degrees, completely 100% online degrees. And that's when the problem became even more egregious.
I guess what you're saying is that the for-profit institutions are really trying to get their hands on those federal dollars and other dollars, perhaps from the states, that are out there available because it's sort of easy money for them.
Exactly. They're very entrepreneurial institutions. And, you know, this goes way back. I wrote an earlier book about the World War II GI Bill. And
Changed everything.
Yeah, it did. And it was a wonderful bill. Most of the people who used it for education or training did not go to college. Many of them didn't yet have their high school degree completed, and instead they used it for vocational training. And a lot of these new schools cropped up overnight, proprietary institutions, mm-hmm. And they were the precursors to what we now call the for-profits. Right away, there were problems with some of them, and they were, you know, just taking advantage of federal dollars. And Congress, bipartisan members of Congress got together and said, we need to do something about this. And they did successfully for the Korean GI Bill. They had some provisions in there to regulate them a bit. So we've managed to do that before. What's different now is that Congress is not coming together to try to regulate these institutions.
The polarization in Congress is affecting this this whole picture.
That's right. Polarization is a big problem now. So we have seen rising polarization in Congress now for since the 1980s, and it's become much worse in recent years. And what I found, you know, we talk a lot about how polarization gets in the way of creating new laws because it leads to stalemate. What I found is it even gets in the way of maintaining existing laws. Public policies, like anything else, as they age, they need updating and maintenance. You can think of it as, you know, an old house. If you've ever lived in an old house, which I have, you find there's, you know, faulty wiring. There are all kinds of things that happen over time that you need to attend to. And we need to do this with public policies. In the past couple of decades, in many policy areas, not just higher education, we have policies that are not functioning well. Unintended consequences crop up. Other policies compete for funds with them. You get policy designs working in ways that they weren't intended to work, and so on. And that's what's happening with the for-profit colleges, as well as other student aid laws. And the net effect of all of this is that we are no longer expanding access to opportunity through higher education effectively.
I'm looking at a quote here from your book. You write, the problem is not that landmark policies were terminated or abandoned. To the contrary, they remained intact, but required maintenance and updating, and that hasn't been happening.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So our major student aid law is the Higher Education Act of 1965, which was signed into law by Lyndon Johnson. who himself felt he had really benefited from being able to go to Southwest Texas State College. He went back there to sign this bill into law. Now, this has to be reauthorized by Congress on a regular basis, and we did it on a regular basis for decades, but now it's long overdue for being reauthorized. The Pell Grant program, which is now part of it, it's our major higher education policy for low-income students. When it was created in the 1970s, it allowed a student to attend a public four-year institution, and it covered nearly 80% of the cost of tuition, room and board, and fees. Now it covers just over 30%.
Well, clearly that's a dramatic shift there. So let me just be absolutely clear with regard to the disadvantaged students, if I could use that word, lower income students. What is keeping them out of school? Is it the fear of the debt, the fact that they can't get loans? What exactly is keeping them from trying?
Well, actually, they are trying. More students than ever enroll in college. If you look at just the front end of, you know, freshman year, who's enrolled, you would think we don't have a problem in the United States today because the freshman class all over the country is very diverse with students from, you know, across the income spectrum and lots of first-generation students. The problem is that when you look 4 years later and even 6 years later, the graduation rates for those students are very poor. And so what's really getting in the way is the cost of college. It's the biggest reason why people drop out is they can't afford the tuition. Or the second reason is they're working so many hours on the side that they can't maintain their studies. And, of course, they're working so much in order to afford it.
Did you say a moment ago that more students than ever are going to college?
Yes.
Because census figures I've seen from 2012 and 2013 show that there's been a dramatic decrease in the number of college students, about a half million, that actually in four-year institutions there's an increase of 1%, and in community colleges a decrease of 10%.
Oh, well, you know, I have an historical perspective, so I'm looking in the long run, not just what's happened in the last 2 years. Right. So if you look from, you know, the 1990s to the present, overall, we have more and more people going to college. Then there was a big boost right after the recession, the financial downturn, and then it's tapered off slightly in the past couple of years. So you're looking at just that most recent dip.
Okay. We're talking with Dr. Suzanne Mettler of Cornell University. She's the author of the book, Degrees of Inequality. By the way, she's taking part in a special program later today titled Degrees of Inequality and will include a reception and discussion right here at the Community Room at UMSL at Grand Center. That's happening from 4 to 6:30. We have more information, by the way, on that on our website. We'll be back to continue this conversation with Dr. Mettler in just a moment. Stay with us. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to Dr. Suzanne Mettler. Dr. Mettler, you say in the subtitle of your book that it is sabotaging the American dream. Just explain that for me, please.
You know, we have such a deeply rooted belief in the United States that if a person works hard, they can better themselves. And bettering yourself is understood in many different ways by different people. But a fundamental aspect of that is being able to develop one's mind, to be able to learn. When I speak with people about, you know, the joy they derive from learning, for people who as adults manage to go back to college, it's a really an extraordinary thing. And so that's fundamental to this American dream. And then as well, of course, the ability to get good jobs and a standard of living so that you can raise a family and pursue your dreams in life. And as well, to be able to contribute to American democracy, to be a person who is poised to be able to be engaged as in civic organizations and in politics and so on. People need education and training in order to be able to do that. So all of that is part of what we hope that education provides. And Americans believe so strongly in access to education being the key that allows us to really have democracy existing in a vibrant way.
But not everybody should go to college. Vocational training is important in many ways, perhaps even more important to some who are better suited for that.
Yeah. Well, there's two things I want to say in response to that. One is that we do need more college graduates, and many businesses will say this. And there are many more people who would like to be getting college degrees who have the ability to go to college, but they're not managing to finish those degrees. I found in the research for this book that today, as I was saying, more students than ever go to college, but it's only those who come from the top quarter of the income spectrum who are very likely to finish their degree within 6 years by age 24. For those individuals, 71% now have college degrees by that point in time. For people in the bottom 75%, the results are very poor, and they've hardly increased since the 1970s for people below median income. For people who grow up in the bottom quarter of the income spectrum, it's now only 1 in 10 who have a college degree by age 24. And it was, 6% in the 1970s, so it's barely increased.
Should business and industry and the corporations be playing a bigger role?
I think they should. Yes, today it's become extremely rare for businesses to pay for people to get additional training that they need. So businesses are saying we need more trained people, but they are not helping to cover these costs.
It's going to have to go that way. We hear a lot of talk about it here in the St. Louis area, that pretty much it's going to have to go that way to correct this imbalance.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And, what's so egregious with the for-profit colleges is they are trying to provide that kind of vocational training, which I think we need much more of in this country, and I think we've done a poor job of. But unfortunately, they are these institutions which don't seem to put students first. They seem to put profits first, and the outcomes have been very poor. They are, by the way, permitted to receive up to 90% of their revenues from government. This is called the 90-10 rule. In fact, they can receive up to 90% of their revenues from one public policy, and that is the Higher Education Act Title IV. It doesn't even count what they receive from the GI Bill and other military-related educational programs. So they really go after veterans as a result.
This could be corrected if the politicians would get off their seats and do something.
Yeah, absolutely. I think of this as the low-hanging fruit to try to improve problems in higher ed. Yeah. It need not be that difficult, but it has been politically difficult in Washington really since the early 90s.
Right. You had indicated off the air that you wanted to put some of this in some historical perspective. Exactly how did you want to do that?
Oh, yeah. People who whose children are getting college degrees today, like my own children, many of us are people who, if we did this thought experiment and asked, well, who was the first member of our extended family to go to college? There was someone in the middle of the 20th century who went to college with help from government, whether it was going to a low-cost public university or college, or it was using the GI Bill or Pell Grants. And then after that, that person started doing better, and then their children got to go to college, and they were able to help pay for tuition and so on. But for people who today are the first in their family to go to college, it's very difficult.
Yeah. What is the role of the states in all of this? I mean, they are a player as well, but we know that virtually every state has its own financial difficulties.
Okay. So historically in the United States, the federal government and the states and the private sector have each played their own roles and worked together for the purpose of promoting higher education. And the states did a fabulous job of this in the middle of the 20th century, of really investing more than ever to create more public universities and colleges. In the 1980s, the federal government started to pull back on financial aid, but the states kept investing, and they did until the 1990s. And then they started having their own fiscal difficulties. Mm-hmm. Well, since the early 1990s, the amount that states invest in higher education has dropped in real terms by 26%. As a result, colleges and universities have had to find some way to make up the difference. And this has been in an era of rising costs. So tuition has gone way up. It's actually gone up by about 112%. They've also been needing to pack more students into the classroom and to use more online courses as a way to cut costs. Mm. And all of these things hurt graduation rates.
But there is a place for online education, is there not? At least supplemental, perhaps, to the normal classroom activity?
I think that there certainly is a place for online education, but I think that our enthusiasm for it has been way out ahead of our understanding of the appropriate pedagogies to use so that students can really learn effectively. With the courses that are taught called MOOCs, we find a lot of people sign up for them. The only people who actually finish these online courses are people who already have a high level of higher education. They're people who've learned how to learn. But for someone who is coming from a disadvantaged background to college and really hasn't had the best preparation for being there, if they're in mostly online courses, they're going to drop out. It's not going to work for them.
Well, if they haven't had the best preparation for being there, then we have to look back at their education in high school, for instance. Jonathan Kozol wrote famously that there's an apartheid system in American education today. Is what you're talking about an extension of what he's saying?
I think that's
right.
Word.
It's a tough word.
Yes. Yeah. No, I think that's right. Well, you know, we still have great inequality in the K-12 education system, mm-hmm. though we've been working on that a lot as a nation. And actually, our high school graduation rates have improved quite a bit over recent decades, whereas the college graduation rates have not improved much at all, particularly for low-income people.
What about getting back to the institutions themselves, I'm not talking about the for-profit institutions. Don't they play a role in this high cost factor? I mean, they compete with each other. They're building new facilities, equipment and that sort of thing, driving the price up in that manner?
Yeah. Well, you know, there's sort of a myth out there that the problem is climbing walls and, you know, spas and all of those kinds of things that institutions are building to try to compete with each other for students. I would say, you know, the economists who've studied this kind of question, they find that's not the real issue. They find that higher education, like healthcare, is something that depends upon human services of professional people. And costs for that kind of thing go up over time because you can't replace it very well. You can't replace teaching very well with technology. I mean, we've tried with online education. So far, that's not working out all that well. I think there will be some ways down the line as we learn how to do it better to have some cost savings in that respect. But the main problem has been the rising costs of public universities and colleges because states have pulled back on how much they invest in them. Mm-hmm.
We don't have much time left, but I want to get a call in. Anne is joining us from St. Louis, has a question concerning tuition, I believe. Go ahead, Anne.
Yes, I applaud your book. I look forward to reading it, and I'm so glad that St. Louis on the Air had you on the show. I would like to say that it's outrageous, the cost of education. It's unfair. It's unjust. And a friend of mine, a very close friend, Willis Harmon, he wrote Global Mind Change. He told me specifically, you know, he got his PhDs from Stanford, I'm pretty sure, Stanford Research. And he said, you know, I learned between the pages of a book at a university. Many people in this day and age with Global Mind Change are learning from the universe. If you want to learn, you learn unlimited. Independent scholarship is awesome. There's no limits to independent scholarship. And I just wanted to say that I hope you'll explore independent scholarship. I mean, Abraham Lincoln was an independent scholar. I think what it was, Microsoft, Bill Gates, he dropped out of college, right? Sometimes college can just limit you.
And thank you for making it.
Thank you so much for having her on.
Would you like to respond to that, Dr. Mettler?
Yes, I would like to. And Anne, thank you so much for your comments. Yes, there are, you know, several people like Bill Gates who are geniuses who dropped out of college famously and have had extremely successful lives without a college degree. And of course, there's, you know, the wonderful Abraham Lincoln example of someone who self-taught. The problem is that that does not work for most people, and particularly if they come from less advantaged backgrounds. They really need the kind of classroom experience where they have a faculty member who is looking them straight in the eye and really engaging them and their peers in conversation and learning together. So I think that we do need changes in higher education, but that moving very much to an independent learning model will probably not allow us to reduce inequality greatly.
If you could wave that magic wand, what would you do to correct the situation?
Wow. Well, waving the magic wand makes it sound easy, and there are many things that need to happen. But I do think that lawmakers need to get back to maintaining existing policies. It sounds, you know, rather simple, but we need to find ways to reauthorize the Higher Education Act and to regulate the for-profit colleges, to improve state funding, et cetera.
Yeah. As you say, no magic wand out there, but hopefully people are listening and will take advantage of what you had to say. Suzanne Mettler of Cornell University, thank you so much for being with us, and we look forward to having you here at Grand Center a little bit later in the day. Dr. Mettler will be here to talk about degrees of inequality, which is also the title of her book. There'll be a reception and discussion in the community room here at UMSL at Grand Center from 4 to 6:30. When we come back, Eric Greitens on resilience. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.